This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
I'm sick with this, I'm sick with this. Since you wasn't a part of my judgment, my own sweet time didn't teach what I found. I didn't recognize simple things anymore. I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated, I don't want to be defeated.
Hello, hi, how are ya? Welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. So good to have you. Man, this is cool. It's a good episode this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, I am your host, Shane Told, and this podcast is all about me, a lead singer, talking to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a band. And yes, we have an amazing front man this week, Mr. Anthony Green. You know him from Circus Survive, you know him from Seosin, you might even know him from his amazing solo stuff. Shout out to the new record out now. So good to have him. Something we've been trying to do for a couple of years now. So it was great that he could take time out of his very busy schedule and speak with me for like an hour. It was just an amazing conversation. We dive into so many things about his early life, about, geez, I just don't even want to spoil it. Just sit back, as they say, fasten your seatbelts and get ready for a wild ride. Before we get into that, thank you so much for listening to this. I hope you're subscribed. I hope you've hit the subscribe button, whatever you're listening to on. Just go boop, hit it so you're in for all the amazing episodes I have coming up in the next few weeks. And of course, as always, I want to remind you guys, if you want to get in touch, it's super easy. You can email me, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com, with whatever you want. If you have suggestions for the show, for upcoming guests, really anything at all, hit me up, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I read all of my email. Also, make sure you check us out on social media. I know I say it every week, but you know, this shit's important. We're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. We have a great Facebook page. Shout out to Neil, Melissa, and Julia for running that for me. They do an amazing job, so go like that page. And if you do like the show, feel free to go on iTunes, write a review, preferably 5 stars, and tell a friend, tell a loved one. Let's keep this thing spreading. As I record this intro, I am in Germany, in Cologne. I'd say it's beautiful, but it really is just super, super gray and depressing at the moment. Which, you know, it happens sometimes here in Europe. But, man, Cologne, what a music town. What a place. People talk about New York and LA and Chicago and London and Melbourne, Australia as these amazing, amazing music markets. And they are, don't get me wrong. But Cologne is right up there. One of the best music cities. So I'm very happy to be spending a lovely day off here. And if you're in Europe, come see my band Silverstein play. We are doing a few shows with the almighty Boy Sets Fire this week, which leads us into a couple festivals. We're doing one in Czech, and we're doing the Veinstream Festival in Germany before we come back to North America, where we are doing 8 Warped Tour shows. We are playing Detroit, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toronto, Buffalo, Scranton, New York, and Boston. So if you're in any of those places, be sure to come out. Come say hi. Feel free to ask me a question about the podcast. I love talking about it, and I love meeting fans of the show on the road. People are always asking me, hey, Shane, when are you going to start doing 2 episodes a week? 1 episode a week, it's just not enough. I've listened to all of them, and I want more. Other people are asking me, hey, Shane, how can I help out the show? Well, first of all, 2 episodes a week is not happening. That would be so much work. 1 episode a week is enough work as it is. But if you do want more, if you do want bonus episodes, bonus content, question and answer sessions with me, maybe some live chats on Facebook where I'm playing some tunes, maybe you want access to Lead Singer Syndrome merchandise, or maybe you want to be a part of a great community with other fans of the show, like-minded individuals, where you have a great group where we talk about everything. Well, look no further than the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. For as little as $6 a month, that gets you in. You get all the stuff I just mentioned. You can also get merchandise shipped to your house every 3 months, patches that are very, very cool. And yeah, did I mention bonus episodes? So check it out, leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. Again, we're talking about $6. We're talking about just one cup of very, very nice coffee. That's very nice coffee, but still only one cup in a whole month. So check it out. It really is what helps me keep the show going, keep the show growing, and helps me keep the lights on, as there is costs associated with running this thing. So again, the link is leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. Before we get into it with Anthony, I also want to give a quick shout out to our main sponsor, rockabilia.com, the best place to buy band merchandise. I bet they got a boatload of Circus Survive shirts. And the reason I think they have a boatload is because they got a boatload of just about everything. Over half a million items, all unique and all officially licensed from the band. We're talking top quality, no knockoffs, no BS. This is the real deal. Best of all, use promo code PCJabberjaw and save 15% off your entire order today. Rockabilia.com, PCJabberjaw, and you're in. Check it out. All right, without further ado, let's get into this week's episode and my conversation with Anthony Green.
So just watch what you say.
What's up, man?
Hey, dude. So sorry about missing you.
No worries. No worries.
Literally like 3 seconds before you called, my youngest son like grabbed like an open can of tomatoes and cut his finger.
Oh, no.
And there was just like, it's not bad. It's just a tiny little cut.
Oh, good.
But it just ensued utter chaos in my house. Like I was like, all right, I'm out the door. And then just screaming and yelling and blood. My wife hates blood and... It's all good.
It's not blood. It's tomato juice. It's okay.
Yeah, it was all mixing together. I was like, "What's what? I don't know what's happening."
Are you good to do this? Do you need a minute?
Yeah, I'm good.
Oh, all right, nice, dude. Well, good to have you, man, on the show. Something we've been talking about for a couple of years.
I feel like it, like 4 years ago or something. 5 years ago, we tried to do it, and then it didn't work out, and our timing's just been bad.
You know, it has been, but you know, it's funny. It was 2 years ago, and I know that because I still had my notes that I wrote up to talk to you, and it was right when Pixie Queen was coming out.
Nice.
Which is funny, yeah. And now you have a new solo record that you just dropped, like, secretly, or however you say that, you know? Like,
I feel like it's funny. We, like, can't talk about albums anymore without dropping albums, you know? Like, dropping an album is, like, that's just what it is now. When you put an album out, it's like you have to drop it. That's, like, it's just like a term now. It's a thing that we have all agreed on. We all drop albums.
I know. It's just weird. Like, the shelf life for all this stuff is so short, you know? And thank God for you being prolific like you are, right? I mean, can you imagine if you just put out a record and 3 years later another record of 10 songs and nothing in between? A lot of artists do that.
I feel like my fear with doing stuff like that is that you don't exercise your creative spirit when you're not writing,
yeah.
You know, and it's just like any muscle. So yeah. If you were to like get really buff and then take 3 years off and then go back to try to get buff again, it would be like starting all over again.
So,
I've definitely
totally.
Done that where I've taken lots of time off of like creative output to just like absorb source material and live my life. And there's always kind of a hump. To get back.
Yeah. There's two ways to look at it too, though. I mean, sometimes you kind of have to stop and smell the roses and get some other, you know, musical or life, shit happening to you to find the inspiration to create. I mean, there's also that part too, but I guess with your life, you have so much going on. That's maybe not a problem either.
See, the thing is like, I always, whenever I was taking those long breaks, that was sort of my reasoning behind it, or, you know, and I think I might have used it as an excuse or a crutch more often than not, where it was like, hey, man, I need to do this. And in reality, I was just avoiding my own insecurity about what I was doing. And last time, and this was like right around Pixie Queen time when I was like going head first into just writing, no matter when I was like, no matter what I was doing. If I was working with Circa, then I was preparing for what was going to come next when Circa took a break. And I started trying to line up all my projects so that I could make them all work in a period of time. And I realized that I can both live my life, absorb inspirational input all around me, and still work at a steady pace where I feel like I'm in touch, in tune rather, with what is like inspiring me to be creative, you know? And I don't necessarily have to look at it like it's like a well that you go and tap in and then you go back to it. It's reliable in that way. It's reliable in the way that it's not always going to be great, you know, but the people who make the most foul shots are the people who take the most foul shots, you know?
I like that. That's great. Coming off the NBA championship game. That's a great little analogy.
I use sports metaphors sometimes, but I know nothing about sports.
Well, you're right on with that one. I'm a big basketball fan, and that makes a lot of sense.
The other day, I said something to this kid where I was like, oh, yeah, she's like the Michael Jordan of being a mom. And the kid looked at me like he was like, who the fuck is Michael Jordan? Like the shoe guy? And I was like, what?
The shoe
guy.
And then
I said LeBron James, and he got it.
I know. It's happening, man. The shift. And even I'm like a believer now. I know. It sucks.
We're
like,
getting old, dude. We're getting old. That's what's happening.
It really is happening. Speaking of getting old, you're a dad. You're a family man. Kids are running around the house cutting themselves on tomato cans. It's really inspiring to me as a guy that I'm trying to get a solo record together, you know, stuff like that. How do you find the time with is it four kids you have now?
Four,
and,
yeah.
And all this time on the road, like I feel like I'm lucky to catch you at home. I mean, what is that like with your family structure? It must be hard to leave sometimes. Like, I can't even imagine what goes on in your head.
Yeah, it's something that it's got its challenges for sure. I mean, people will say that to me a lot. They'll ask me like, "Hey, where do you find the time?"
Yeah.
But there's so much time, dude. There's so much time. Like, in my vision of it is that like I wish I didn't have to sleep as much as I do. I wish there's so much time. And, you know, when the kids are in bed, I work, you know, and then when I wake up in the morning, I work. Like, I luckily don't need as much sleep, I think, as a normal person. I only sleep a few hours a night. And then every week or two, I'll like crash for an entire day. I think that my mental, like, chemistry is made very suitable for this. Yeah. You know, like I have a compulsion toward the way that creating music and being immersed in music makes me feel. And so in my nature of like, whether you want to say it's like an addict's nature or a compulsive person's nature, I really get a lot out of my time spent playing music, studying music, writing lyrics. You know, it's not like I'm saving up and I'm trying to do it to I really enjoy doing it. So it really eases a lot of like the stress and anxiety that I get out of either being a dad or just living in this world. So it's like a joy for me.
Totally.
So it's never like I'm toiling with any of it. And I think that when you do something that you love like that and you really have that relationship with what you're doing, then it's like the time never becomes an issue. You know, you never have enough.
Wow. It's great stuff. I mean, were you always like that? Like, let's go back to the beginnings of your life. I mean, I know you've struggled with depression, addiction throughout your whole life, your adolescence. But what was it like growing up, and how did music play this role in your life early on?
I mean, okay, so I can remember escaping into albums as like my first memories of being alive. Like, I remember putting on my brother's Walkman and listening to Porno for Pyros or James Addiction or Metallica.
Yeah.
And Living Color and, man, like, you know, and getting lost. I would imagine myself playing drums in the band on stage. Like it was,
yeah.
And growing up, I was the youngest of four boys who were all born within a couple years of each other. And then there was a decade gap, or a little over a decade gap before I was born. And I sort of didn't feel like I belonged to their group. I always felt like the mascot of my brothers. Like, okay. I always felt like I was running around after them. And, you know, I had a brother that was just loved REM and New Order and stuff like that. And I would take little bits of music from them. And I don't know, as long as I can ever remember it, I was obsessed with it. Just hearing the Beatles in my dad's car, and never like thinking it was something I would do as a living, but I definitely went to it as for escapism, to feel good. I put on concerts for my parents, lip syncing to like Kokomo, that Beach Boys song.
Oh, I know it well.
My brothers called me Kokomo for like,
I love
for
it.
Like 20 years. Like they still will be like, yo, Kokomo. Like it's, you know. And so, and then I think that like evolution, every kid, a lot of kids grow up in the suburbs, you know, yeah. I was a privileged, very privileged kid, you know, I sort of got, I got lost into things that would making me feel better about myself. I was a large kid. My mom, God bless her, had this mentality of like, oh, you're sad? Here's some Ilio's pizza at 10:30. Oh, you got teased at soccer practice? Like, let's eat ice cream and pizza before you go to bed. And I ended up, you know, like a big kid and getting picked on for that. And I didn't like myself. There were things going on at home. You know, my parents are wonderful people. My dad and I have a special relationship now because of it. But there was a lot of physical stuff that went down in my house that really fucked me up as a sensitive kid. Okay. And they were trying their best with what they had. But I think that my direction was always heading toward ways of dealing with pain.
Yeah.
And, you know, music was such a great way of dealing with pain as a kid. And then I found, you know, drinking, and I found destruction, and I found, you know, drugs. And it sort of evolved into this thing that for many years I saw, even in the beginning, like when I started playing in punk bands and all that stuff, it was like side by side with just shit that took me away, made me feel better, made me like cope and deal with whatever was going on in my life. And I think that even after I was in a band and I started making money, you know, playing music, and I started feeling good about that, it was very difficult for me to balance how influential the like drugs and alcohol can be in taking your attention away from the things that are important in your life. And it like clears a pathway toward pleasure, which is like something that sometimes has to be, pain has to be endured. And as a young person, you're not, especially in this culture, you're not really taught that pain is to be endured and to learn from, you know, you're always being taught how to run away from it. And so
at some point in time,
it just overtook everything. And it started to overtake everything. It was like a tidal wave that just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And for as long as I can remember, it was something that was a part of my life. And I, you know, I'm 4 years off of heroin and alcohol.
Congratulations. And good for you.
Thanks. But I still feel very much like a new person in the world. Like I'm learning about relationships. I'm learning about coping. I'm learning about communication. And a lot of it feels like stuff I missed out on because I was just so busy running away from pain my whole life.
Right. That is interesting about coping with pain versus taking something to ease the pain. You know, and learning that mechanism. That really is interesting. It's something I don't think I've heard put quite eloquently like that, but it is true.
You know, that's where music comes up, is because when I got clean for the last time, the biggest thing in my life, and this is sad to say because I have these four beautiful children, but I felt this amazing urge, like, yeah, to be a father and get my shit together. But I felt like, yo, you have to get your shit together, and you gotta use this thing that you have to its full extent. I'm taking for granted the fact that you have this output that can ease your pain. And then I started sort of obsessively going toward making music and playing music like twice as hard as I had been, you know. And I feel like now that is like my main coping mechanism with everything. And it was always there and I was always using it, but I didn't see it. I had so much energy put into finding all these other pathways of dealing with my anxiety and my stress and my fucking self-hatred and all that shit. And once I got clean the last time, I really started using music more as like a drug. And it's in that way, it's become like my spiritual devotion.
Incredible.
Like, I think it's my purpose.
Incredible. So going back to when you were a kid, you know, and you're listening to Beatles records and the Porno for Pyros reference, I haven't thought about, that's a great record, man. That song, Pets.
Yeah.
What a great.
Oh my God.
Man, what a
it's
riff.
So good.
And you know, it's funny.
I always hear him singing. He screamed in that first song, like, I got the devil in me. Yeah. And I'm like, oh man, I used to sing that all the time. I love it.
Yeah, I know. And it's funny because, you know, I don't know. So many people have emulated your voice, you know, and so, you know, over obviously imitated you and stuff, which we can get into that. But you have a distinctive voice. I don't know if it comes from Perry Farrell as an influence. That's very interesting. But, you know, being a kid and all of a sudden you're just singing along to stuff on the radio or whatever, did anybody like turn their head and go, damn, Anthony, you can kind of carry a tune over there? Or was that something that you built up over years of just fucking around, you know, in punk bands and whatever?
I think that I was pretty annoying to people in my life as a young man. Like, I was Kokomo? Very loud.
Okay.
Yeah, I was always I was the class clown. Like, I was the first person to be able to like make a goof out of himself for a laugh, because it like made me feel like everybody liked me or accepted me.
Okay.
So I feel like nobody, like, I could be walking around singing and screaming and nobody would have, you know, they would just been like, that's him just wanting weird attention. You know, it wasn't until I got older, I started feeling like I gravitated toward these people who were like in local bands and playing music. And I wanted that. I saw that. And I saw that kinship and I wanted to be part of it. It wasn't until I started doing that and started like screaming and singing where people would be like, yo, that's really cool. And I never, you know, I think everybody sort of imitates the person that inspired them or people that inspired them. I mean, I don't know if my voice had anything to do with Perry Farrell, but I know that people like he and, you know, people like Bjork and people who had unique voices definitely made me feel confident in my weirdness.
Right. Yeah, I guess you must have realized at some point you're different, at least in terms of your range of your voice, you know, being able to sing much higher than other bands, because they're, you know, I don't want to say that you started, you know, that trend or whatever you want to call it of just bands singing maybe in some cases higher than they should.
I think it was Claudio, honestly.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. Claudio, or,
I feel like,
or
I would
drive in, sure, like.
Yeah, you know, there you go, too. There, oh, man, you know, you don't hear, like, honestly, if you want to think about high voices and range, Barry Manilow started it all.
Well, I mean, you know, but you must just, is it lost on you the fact that that was such a thing that you kind of created in this scene? And do you care about it? Is it something, because I'm sure you're going to downplay when I ask you that question, but there's a, you know, there's an importance like there of something that you've at least popularized.
I feel that it's mostly a dangerous endeavor to over-evaluate one's importance and things like that.
Sure.
You know,
very diplomatic answer. I like that.
Not as much as a downplay, but like, I just don't see it like that. I feel like very much like I was given like the opportunity by people who came before me to feel like credible and to feel validated with what I, with my own weirdness, my own, you know, there were so many people that came before me doing things where they were fearless about what they, about their eccentricities. And I think that if it wasn't for people like that, then I would have been lost.
Right.
And I really don't see my own relevance as being something that like aligns with what other people see or say. And I love being living in this dimension where, like, every once in a while I can kind of dip into a place where somebody sees that in me or in my thing, But it, again, I think it like it's fun and it's interesting, and I get a little bit of a drunken kick out of it now and then. But it's not, it's certainly not real, and I would feel like it would hurt anything that anybody really likes about the true nature of my creativity if I was to start eating my own shit, so to speak.
There you go. There you go. So, you know, I know a lot about, you know, your career and stuff and over the years, and you know, from my own perspective, it's a little different, you know, obviously kind of coming up with you at the same time, but not actually ever knowing you, which is kind of weird, being in the same circles and, you know.
Didn't you tour with Seosin? Didn't you do like a big Seosin tour after I left?
Never. No, we did. The only thing we ever did was like some festivals with them and like random one-offs. And I know all those guys from running into them at like festivals and whatever. But I never knew you, which I sort of keep
to myself a little bit in the social world, especially like with the music like stuff. I hate to call it a scene because I feel like scene is something that happens in a local environment, you know, like I feel like you start qualifying what happens on a mainstream scale as a scene, and it's just, that's all it is, just commodifying something. But I feel like in the way that we all, the circles that we all kind of like exist in a professional and artistic way, it's almost like difficult for me to socialize and maneuver. I get anxiety about it, and I like, especially for those years, you know, where like from 2000 on, when you guys were a band and when we were all starting, I wasn't like much of a social guy. The only time you ever really saw me out is if I was like getting loaded with people.
Right. Well, that's fair. but you know, I just want to talk about the Seosin thing that happened in 2000, in 2003, because it was pretty amazing. You know, I remember Silverstein, our first record came out in, you know, May or something of 2003. The first Seosin EP came out around the same time. And I remember being on tour and just everyone talking about this band and everybody listening to this band. And all you had was an EP, but it was like everywhere you went, all over the country, everyone's talking about this band, and then boom, you're gone. It was like in less than a year. You know, from when I heard about the band until it. That is such a crazy thing to have had happen, and for you to be here now with all this success in Circus Survive, solo, back in Seosin. When you left Seosin at that moment, I'm sure there's a lot going on in your head, but did you ever think you were gonna still be here 15 years later as a professional musician?
No, I can remember being like at home and playing music with Colin, like after I had left, and coming to peace with the fact that this was no longer going to be like a thing that I had in my head. Like when I was living in California in Seosin, I started to believe that I would be a professional musician. I'd get, you know, and all this stuff. And then after I came home, I decided to kind of follow this intuition. I sort of came to peace with the fact that, hey, listen, if this is something I get to do now and then, you know, and if I can sit in the hallway and play for my friends, that is something I have to find gratification in. Mm-hmm. I can't look for like a certainty here, and I can't look for like, you know, I can't look for some kind of validation from this anymore because it's over.
Right.
I was convinced they were going to be the biggest band in the world, and that the luckiest that I was going to be was someday maybe they would like invite me to go play a song from the EP. Like I imagined, like, yeah, maybe someday we'll be friends again and they'll invite me to go play a song on stage and like it'll be cool and I'll get to play that song again.
But was there a regret when you watched them, you know, grow and like they got a new singer, the whole thing, you know, with the auditions and they're trying to find, you know, your second coming, and then, you know, Cove comes in the band and he's a good singer. He's a very good singer. He's not you.
Yeah. He's great.
But seeing him there and being like, well, I can sing like this. I can perform maybe better than this. Was it weird for you witnessing that go down?
Yes, it's very weird. It was an important ego check in my life. It was like one of the first great times where I had like a, I had a real problem where I was like, I really have to put my ego in check and figure out what the fuck I'm doing this for. Because if I'm doing this with some kind of recognition, or if I'm doing this with some kind of popularity, I'm most certain I'm going to be disappointed forever. And I had to align what my mind and my spirit were together for finding my purpose in making music. And it was really important to go through that. It was very painful and extremely confusing.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had no guidance in it. But looking back on it now, I'm so grateful for that time, because what I did have was other people who were really grateful to make music with me. And because of that, I started really learning how to like at first process my emotions with all this stuff, my fears, through like creative output.
Totally. Do you think if you stuck it out in Seosin with all that hype, you guys would have been, you know, again, hate to use the word scene, but the biggest band in the scene, like another The Used, Taking Back Sunday. Do you think you could be at that level or even bigger?
I think we would have been like Metallica, like bigger than Metallica if I stayed in the
Perfect. Maybe like Death Clock?
Yeah, we would have been like a thing where we would like only play on top of a volcano every 5 years, and it would like No, I don't know.
Sell the world.
Honestly, yeah. It probably would have been the worst thing ever for all of us. I tend to try to look at like moments in my past that are, you know, either difficult or questionable as things that like all were like, you know, leading us up to where we are now.
Sure.
So I think about it sometimes. I remember hearing Bo talk about in some interview, talk about how he thinks the band could have been like as big as Metallica or something if I didn't leave. So I was kind of just saying that.
Well, I knew it was tongue in cheek, but
I couldn't sleep for years. I couldn't think about those guys without getting anxious.
Yeah.
I had nightmares where they were showing up at circus shows and then everybody left and they hate and all this stuff. So having them in my life, having Bo and Chris and Alex in my life is like such a positive force, and making music with them casually, like throughout the last couple of years, has been one of the most fulfilling creative experiences I've ever had. And I would use it as an opportunity to tell people like that are going through differences with other people, whether it's like friendships or whether it's romantic or something like that, that it's worth it to stick it out and to be positive and loving. And because that's the only way that stuff like that ever gets figured out and squashed, is that by being open and loving.
Totally. It's incredible that you say that you had this for years, you know, you had these feelings of inferiority and all this, even though Circus Survive, I mean, is a bigger band than Seosin. They, you know, you guys were bigger than them relatively quickly, I think.
See, I don't, again, like, I don't even see that as a thing where, like, it was, like, I don't even know if that is, like, from my perspective, I just saw these guys making music in harmony with a new person who I couldn't. And then I felt like I couldn't have done that. You know, like I wasn't able to do that with them. And I felt jealous and insecure about that.
Yeah.
It was never a thing where the band was ever any bigger and that ever gave me a good feeling. Because, again, that was like not something that was in my radar. I wasn't trying to be like bigger than anybody. I wanted to just feel good about what I was doing, and I wanted to feel like at peace with that, and I couldn't be, because I left it in such a childish way. I left it in such an you know, there was no closure for anybody, and it was a you know, if it was something I could go back and fix, I would have communicated.
Right.
I would communicate with
it. I remember it. You know, I know you've downplayed it a little bit, like leaving the band now, however many years ago it was, like 14 years ago. But I remember you kind of making a statement calling them like California douchebags. And, you know, it was pretty like, it seemed very volatile, you know.
Dude, I was so wasted when I gave that interview. Okay, so what the thing you're talking about, this guy from Alternative Press comes to the studio in Baltimore where we're making like either Drew Turner or On Letting Go or something.
Yep.
And
shout out to Brian McTernan.
And at the time, like I was, you know, I'd been out of rehab a couple years, and I wasn't like, I was trying to not drink, but I was back on like the drink.
All right.
And I was trying to get I was just like, I told the guy who was doing the interview, like, hey, we're going out to drink now. Don't put it in the interview, and don't put anything I say after this point in the interview. And then sort of just told him, like, how I felt at the time, which was one-sided. And, like, I probably was talking more about myself being a douchebag than them, but using them as, like, my mirror, you know, so to speak, like, projecting.
Yeah. But,
he then took everything I said and put it in there because, of course, I mean, that was his job at the time. But I felt really stupid about it, and I learned a valuable lesson about talking shit.
Yeah.
I learned a huge valuable lesson.
There you go. Obviously, your voice has evolved, and it's funny when, you know, you go back in the band, you know, back in Sailson again, and you do the record.
Yeah.
You know, and in some ways, you don't sound like the same guy on the first EP.
Yeah.
How could you? You know, you're in a different, completely different place. Do you find that kind of ironic that they were searching so hard to find you when you weren't even you?
I thought it was, you know, at the time, even now when I look back on it, I feel like it probably would have been smarter for them if they had just, like, started over with a new person that did their own thing, and they maybe found somebody that was, like, as passionate as me about it and not necessarily as similar to me sounding.
Totally. Yeah, because obviously the comparison will be there forever. I'm
glad that they carried on, like, now, because I think that what they gave to the world in my absence was very valuable. And a lot of those songs, you know, like, I'm Not Alone, or You're Not Alone, or whatever, like, you know, those songs, like, spoke to people.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I'm grateful to be part of that history. And honestly, being able to go play shows with that band now is such a – it's such a victorious feeling in my soul, being able to continue to, like, grow that idea, you know?
Yeah. No,
I feel so lucky.
I think it's awesome that you're able to do all these different creative outlets. And for you as a, like you've explained, your personality, you need this. So it's incredible. When you know, with Cove, obviously Cove's been very supportive of you being back in the band, and which is cool. But I know for a long time you didn't play his songs live.
Yeah.
And now you are. Was that like a, you don't want to step on anybody's toes? Like, you weren't,
no, I like, just,
what,
like, it was just not,
what was the decision or the feeling there?
I don't really, it's not that I don't like his songs, because his songs are great and some of them are incredible. I love Voices. I think Voices is the one that is, like, the ones that speaks to me the most. But when I'm not, like, a performer in the sense where, like, Brandon Urie is a performer and he can get up there and put his heart and soul into, like, anything. Like, it's very difficult for me to get up there and to, if I was to be trying to sing something that I wasn't feeling or didn't believe, I would just feel, I would get sick.
Yeah.
You know, it would make me sick. And so for years it was just like, yeah, I don't really feel a connection with these things that I need to feel in order to go up and put myself into it. So I'm going to, I'm not going to do that. And, you know, when we were talking about it, I think the Voices came on, like, some station that I was listening to, and I was like, fuck, this is so good. I was, like, listening to, like, Coheed Radio or something like that, and that came on, and I was like, man, this would be so fun to sing, and I do kind of identify with all of the lyrics.
Yeah.
And I was singing it for weeks in my head before I even texted Chris from Seosin, was like, yo, maybe we practice this. And he was like, yo, that would be great. And then I think I mentioned something to Cove about if it would bum him out, and he said no. So
was it, you must have, I mean, did you listen to those albums, the Seosin stuff they put out when you weren't in the band? Because I'd imagine
if
it was, you listened to them? Because I probably wouldn't have,
Solid Ground is, like, the best record. I feel like it's so underrated from, like, I mean, I'm a fan in a different way of Seosin. And when that's my favorite. The last song on that record is, like, 10 minutes long. It's, like, the best song they ever did. And I love it so much. There's so much in that record is incredible. I think that, you know, when you send a band of creative, you know, expeditionaries like that into a mainstream atmosphere where they're like writing with songwriters and they're having people take the helms that might be steering in different directions, I think it becomes incredibly difficult and volatile with creative members. And I think that it affects a lot of bands in a negative way. And I, without, you know, with the risk of like bumming them out or anything like that, is I think that really splintered their relationships with each other, like trying to write in that way with having the labels be involved. And a positive note is like now, you know, when we get to work together, we've all been through that and they've been through that. And I think that we really can now go straight for the jugular and just write what makes us happy and write what makes us want to play. And that's, you know, going to be the best result for anybody.
Totally. And I feel like there's a lot of differences between Circus Survive and, you know, your relationship within the band and how Seosin operates. I know Seosin's very like, it seems like a very A-type personality, like very stressful. Whereas Circus Survive is maybe more of a, you guys are more free spirits in the studio. You guys are like kind of experimenting a little bit more. I don't know if that's accurate. That's my impression. Do you think that that's kind of related to how Circus Survive has kept such a consistent lineup?
I think that, you see, the reason why Circus kept the lineup is because we were never Circus Survive as like a brand. We're Circus Survive as like a group of brothers, like from the beginning, almost coming out of the Seosin experience, feeling like, hey, this felt very professional to me. And, it, you know, mostly because I was young and didn't know how to communicate. I didn't like that. And I wanted to be in an environment where I felt like if I got hit by a car and couldn't sing, that the band would rally behind me and do everything they could to value my life, you know?
Wow.
And, and so Circa was never a thing where it was like, hey, man, we're trying to make Circa. It was like, yo, we're trying to make each other have this place. And in doing that, like we inadvertently sort of created this tiny little community for ourselves where like not only do we have that with each other, but there's like a core fan base that like feel that with us that aren't like linked into like a merch type of like fucking fan club deal. It's like, yo, here's the symbol, here's the message, here's a bunch of music. It's available for free if you want it. Everything is available for free if you want it. You know, all you have to do is sing and dance and you feel good.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's why Circa has the same lineup. If it was never a thing, an intentional thing, you know, unless the intention was to just take care of one another.
Totally, totally.
Seosin was like, you know, has that. But at the beginning, you know, we're young kids. We didn't really know what the fuck we wanted. You know, we didn't know how to communicate. I didn't know how to communicate. And like, you know, to have that now with them is way better. I feel like I couldn't have had it when I was 22.
No, totally. One thing you've done a lot of, and you've got one coming up, plug in your 10-year tour for your first solo record, Avalon, I actually own on vinyl.
Sick.
There you go. Yes. Not a repress, original pressing. But you've done a lot of 10-year tours. You've done at least two that I know of. Did you enjoy doing this? Because a lot of people shy away from them and you seem to embrace them.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a lot. I've heard it from things from different sides of like people's opinions about it. To me, like touring and celebrating music is all a part of the same spectrum.
Yeah.
And like feeling grateful for what I have is like part of my thing that gets me through my life. And so I see every opportunity. I try to see every opportunity that I have to play music and to perform and to grow as just like a gift. So I just see the fact that people want to celebrate something after 10 years as like a hugely positive thing in being able to continue what I love doing. I know that there are other viewpoints of it. I know that there's other perspectives of it. That's the one that I feel most connected with, you know, to be able to look back as somebody who's a very difficult time keeping commitments and who has a hard time sticking with stuff in general, like being able to celebrate 10 years of something, especially this thing that I love more than anything in the world, is just nothing but a victory for me.
No,
and so
I agree with you completely.
You know,
I think it's a good way to put it. I think some people want to
oh, another 10-year tour, it's just cashing in. But, you know, from my own personal experience, when you do a 10-year tour and you and everyone knows what song's coming next, but they're excited about it. They're not not boring. It's the opposite of boring, which is so cool because you don't have that ever with a regular sort of performance.
I never saw it growing up. Like, I never saw, like, I feel like it's a fairly new thing.
Totally.
And, like, it's weird to me when somebody's, like, cashing in. Like, are you fucking kidding me, dude? Like, I own my own small business. There are literally zero opportunities I have to cash in on anything. I see one thing coming my way where I'm like, oh, wait, here's something that I can do that other people might like, and I don't mind doing it, and it feels cool to me. And then all of a sudden, people want to come out of the woodwork. I feel like, you're cashing in. Like, dude, what do you want from me? You want me to be, like, destitute and poor forever? Like, I can say no to opportunities left and right that don't align with, like, my ethos, you know?
Sure.
And I do it all the time. But, like, I don't see how this is a bad thing. Like, okay, I love playing, like, free. I like jamming a lot, where I can just play and be lost in a moment and not have necessarily have to play a song, you know? Like, I love that. I can't do that all the time. I could go out there and do, like, a Mars Volta thing. Well, I mean, they have classically, like, figured out jams, but I would love more than anything to go out and for 45 minutes just jam and make stuff up and have little moments, you know, for, like, that 1 minute of synchronicity, all right. The weirdness for the last 10 can go, you know, can get fucked. I love those moments.
Sure.
But I can't go out and do that. That's just part of my. So it's like every tour for me is cashing in because I got to go play songs. I can't just go jam and make stuff up. And, like,
right.
To me, that's a compromise. Like, I still add little tiny bits of improvisation and I make stuff up and I go off. But I also see the value in celebrating what people like. People like to hear that song. They like to hear the lyrics they bought on the record, you know. And that doesn't make me feel pigeonholed, you know, as much as it used to. It's like makes me feel like lucky, you know, and I celebrate it. So it's like,
yeah,
when something comes down my path that I think is like fucking sweet and it's an opportunity for me to like put enough food on like the table for my kids so that I can continue to make music and get them a halfway decent, like, you know, life, then dude, I'm gonna totally jump for it.
There you go. I was just thinking when you were talking about if in 1996 I could have saw Metallica do Master of Puppets from start to finish.
Holy shit.
At 15
right?
years old. Can you, like, that
would
have.
Holy shit.
I would have bought all the tickets for that. I mean, you know?
Yeah.
Jeez, yeah.
I mean, think about going to see At the Drive-In play In Casino Out from front to back.
There you go.
Like, I would seriously pay $80 for that.
Maybe 85 or maybe 95 with service charges.
Let's be honest. I would probably hit up 90 people to get on the guest list. First.
Absolutely. We both would. I just phoned a friend to get into the Paramore show next week. I'm very excited about that.
I'm really hoping I can get into one of those shows like while I'm on this tour or where I see them this summer. I'm a huge fan of that band and their new record is so good.
Me
Fake
too.
Happy.
And you know what? I haven't seen Paramore since literally the first album before Misery Business and all that. So I have I've seen the videos and bought all the records and listened to it, but I've never seen them perform. So I'm excited, which is a good way to be when you're a 37-year-old man still excited about music, I guess.
Yes, and, I love that.
Here we are together.
Let me ask you a question.
Go.
So
ask me a question.
How do you do this all the time? I was listening to a couple of the ones that you did previously while I was in Australia recently, and
cool.
I think it's like, how do you get into doing podcasts? I know you have a family too, right?
No, I'm single. I don't have any kids. I'm not married.
All right, there you go. So, you just literally answered my question.
maybe, but you know, this show started just from a funny name. Somebody was talking about lead singer syndrome and like making a joke about me having it. And, you know, so it was a term we'd toss around, you know, whenever I do something kind of diva-ish. And and then, I don't know, I just thought it was would be a pretty cool idea to have a lead singer interview another lead singer and talk about that stuff. And I thought the name was hilarious. And I was like, I have to do this. So here I am,
when
like
you go,
130 episodes later.
That's insane to me.
Yeah.
When you pick the people that you interview – How do you pick them?
Well, I don't just go for a big name. Like it's nice to have somebody that's going to bring, you know, oh, push us on social media and then a bunch of people listen to it. But if anybody has a unique story, that's great. Like, I don't care how popular the band is if it's a unique story. But I'll even push shit. Like, there's this band, you probably haven't heard of them. They're called Darko. They're a punk, they're a punk band from the UK. They put out probably my favorite record of 2017. They've never even been to America. They've never toured overseas in America. And I was like, I want to talk to this fucking guy. I want to know about him. I can't read any interviews about him, so I'm putting him on the show. And honestly, one of my most listened to episodes was that guy nobody even
knew
about.
That's awesome.
So it's really cool. Like, I get a lot of satisfaction out of doing this too. So...
Do you find that, like, talking to creative people, and I'm sure that not everybody's the same, but do you find that it inspires you to be talking to people who are creatively active like that?
It totally does. But what it more reinforces is how we're all kind of the same. We all kind of came up, like, feeling a little lost, and then we had this guitar, and first of all, no singers ever started as singers. They all started they got a guitar or like something, you know, else, and then they were the only ones in their friends that could kind of carry a tune, and then here they are, like, you know, however many years later doing this, and so many people say, I don't even feel like I'm a lead singer, you know, and all these kind of things happen, and that's my favorite, just to reinforce my own life and my own path, and I don't feel alone, you know, I feel like I'm like a kinship with all these people, and I've made so many friends through this thing too. It's unbelievable, you know.
It's really cool. So,
I can't even
tell you how many people in the last few years have been like, dude, you ought to do this podcast.
Yeah.
And I generally try not to do too much stuff like that. And I remember hearing the name of it and being like, oh my God, I don't want to do that.
Oh yeah.
I'm so afraid of people thinking, like, you know, I definitely have like a fear about like being the lead singer dude who like is like making it hard for people, or like, you know, that dick bag walking around with a bottle of Jack Daniels, like screaming shit at people, being a fucking dick, you know, like, I get worried about that.
Totally. And we make fun of those people on the show all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of it, is that it's tongue in cheek, but I think
listening to your show after I was like, oh man, this will be cool.
Good. Well, thanks for being here, man. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but a couple more things. I want to talk about your new solo record, Would You Still Be In Love? Quite a departure from Pixie Queen. I mean, you're talking about way more stripped down, you know, guitar and vocals. What was the decision there to go that route, you know, rather than the full instrumentation like you've done in the past?
I think it was like coming off the heels of writing and recording The Amulet, where there was just so much. And I have been writing songs since Pixie Queen that were just, you know, I was sitting there writing them and workshopping them at the open mic night in my town, and like seeing how they played live. And I got the songs to a point where like I had miracles. Like, there's a song on my first solo record called Miracle Sun. And when I wrote that song, I wrote it in its entirety, and then I played it so many times for people, you know, after shows, or, you know, like traveling around, almost busking, just like playing. I'd go out and play some acoustic songs, and it evolved in a way where I could play it from front to back. It wasn't like a studio recording type of thing. And I started feeling like with The Amulet, my voice just over all of the drums and all of the loud guitars felt like it was just like, it felt like it didn't have the geography that I wanted it to.
Okay.
And I think that when you strip back things, it gives you like this ability to be able to sing really soft and delicate, but still be heard. And then when you go high or you go loud or harder, then you really feel it differently. And I listened to the Feist album Pleasures a bunch, and there's like songs on that album where you can hear her feet tapping up against the ground, or her chair creak as she moves in it while she's playing guitar. And I really wanted to have a record where it felt like you felt if you were sitting with me listening to me play. And it was like, very conscious between me and Will to try to do that and to make sure the guitar takes and the vocal takes were live. And then as we were doing it, I would be like, oh, let's put a glockenspiel here. Or like, let's bring in Keith and he'll play drums. And it was so hard not to fill it up with massive amounts of shit. And just because of how we are with people. So,
I mean, that's
how we are with. Go ahead.
No, no, you go ahead. How we are with.
I think it was like an experiment in like simplicity.
Right.
A lot of the songs we filled up with other stuff and then we drew it all back.
Yeah. No, I mean, it would be interesting to do a remix or reimagined record and put in all that shit. You know, like down the road as a kind of reissue. That would be an interesting idea. But I'm sure by the time you get to that point, you're going
to
be moving on. A tour, yeah.
It would be cool to do a tour where we play, like we have the live band playing a lot of the stuff.
Absolutely. I had this question that I wrote when we were going to talk 2 years ago, and I still have it here in my notes, and I wanted to ask you. I found this with Pixie Queen, which was a record I really enjoyed. I found there was an interesting juxtaposition because the record is very major key, and sometimes very upbeat, but the lyrics are absolutely crushing on that.
Yeah.
And it's like equal parts sadness and almost apologetic. And the songs are so good. And I want to ask you how you've, if you're still in the same space when you write your solo lyrics as you were then, or if it's shifted in the last 2 years.
I don't know. I don't ever really know what space I'm in when I'm writing something until like I'm farther away from it. And then I can look back and say it, you know, it's so close to me now. Still, I know that when I was reading Pixie Queen, I was very much trying to communicate with my wife through a lot of those songs. And I think that with Would You Still Be In Love was still the same way.
Yeah.
But I was just saying much different things. Like Pixie Queen was almost like a please believe me type of thing. And maybe Would You Still Be In Love is more like a I don't give a shit anymore.
All right. Well, dude, thank you. I got a couple more fan questions if you don't mind before I let you go.
Dude, I don't mind at all. You're not in any. I've like spaced out a bunch of time for this, so you're not in any rush.
Nice, dude. Okay, I got the first question is from Brendan Potter, who's a big fan of the show and a big fan of you. He asks if you were supposed to do a project with Max Bemis of Say Anything, and also there's a rumor that there was an extra song called the Hangover Song. Or sorry, the party song, which was, I guess, a kin song to the Hangover song. Is that true? That's his question.
I don't remember even tracking the vocals to that Say Anything song.
All right.
Because we were in his tour bus on a Night of Warp tour. And I was just drunk that whole summer and don't really remember it. But I do remember being like, holy shit, when it came out and being like, holy shit, I don't remember this at all. Like, I could have been on 1,000 pounds of Xanax and drunk when I did that.
Wow.
So I have a hard time with a lot of those years. But I do remember somebody else asking me if I was going to be in a project with Max. And I don't know if we ever talked about it or not. I do have the tendency of, like, finding people that I enjoy their company and then just starting bands with them because that's just, like, what I do. So I wouldn't be surprised if Max and I had talked about doing something, you know, but I would love to work with that guy. He's incredibly talented.
He is incredible. And a question here. I don't know who wrote this. It's written pretty kind of funny, so I'm going to just read it out.
Okay.
Drugs. Fucking heroin, man. Right now, it's a total epidemic in America. Do you ever worry about what you say about it could glorify it in some way? Because people put you on a pedestal, man. Like, my best friend thinks you are the greatest singer of all time. That's in caps. So the greatest singer of all time was a heroin addict for years and still managed to make all this amazing music and still raise a beautiful family. It's scary a little bit that some aspiring musician could think he needs it. And where do you think you would be if you never touched the stuff?
Oh, my God. There's like 100 questions in that one question.
Yeah, but I couldn't dumb that down. Yeah. I couldn't summarize that. I had to give you the full unabridged version, yeah. You know?
Tell you what, first time I ever started thinking about if I ever glorified heroin, and I don't think I did. I don't think I do. I'm not sure if I ever have ever spoken about it without it immediately following how much of destruction sure. It has posed in my life. I think the only time I ever even find the only instances of when I ever even find time to talk about it is when I'm trying to be precautionary. That being said, I remember almost in my head deciding that I wanted to try it when I was like 12 or 13, worshiping Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, I've heard that on the show before. Yeah.
Like, I remember being a kid and thinking, like, I would do that because he did that. And so I think that the question more or less is that how do we value our idols or our contemporaries, our peers? How do we put people on a pedestal? Why do we do that? And what about it innately serves us and a purpose for us? And I think that we end up looking at people like that, whether it's an athlete or a musician, and putting them up on this thing because it helps take the responsibility of us to do what we're meant to do as human beings, as great individuals who possess the power to do anything. And I think that, you know, as a young person looking up to people, you want to feel like they're a superhero. You want to feel like they're something greater than you. It's like impossible to fathom that you have that power to do that, whether it's fucking, you know, to be like Michael Jordan or fucking right. Be like Kurt Cobain or whatever. And there's like a disconnect there that helps create this idea that people are these role models. I am not a fucking role model. I can't take responsibility for people looking up to me or misinterpreting what I do or what I say. I would lose my shit and I would never make music again if that was the case.
Right.
You know, I see artists go around nowadays glorifying sex and violence and especially materialism, just insanely gross materialism. Look at all my shit. Look at all the shit I have. I'm better than everybody. I got all this shit. I'm the best. Like that to me is so toxic and so poisoning. It's so poisoning with greed and with things and with money and with possessions. And that's what your end game is in life, is to have the most shit, the most stuff. And, you know, there's also a thing where people are killing themselves now more than ever.
Yeah.
And I think that those two things are very much aligned. Now, any damage I've done to my fans by doing heroin or talking about doing heroin, you know, I couldn't be more bummed out about. Like, right. I know that it's happened. I know there's things I've said that have been misinterpreted and misconstrued. And I know that there are people that probably saw me smoking and decided to smoke or do whatever. I really have to just let those things go and try to carry my message forth in that way and carry it in a non-judgmental way and in a self-inflating way. You know, somebody comes up to me, "How you're a fucking piece of shit. You're a high horse, whatever." I can't solve their problem for them. I'm not going to be what they want me to be. I'm not going to get angry at it. It doesn't serve me any purpose in getting angry at it. You know, I would love for somebody who is having a problem with heroin or with drugs to be able to learn that it is possible to have a completely different life than the life that they're living, like addicted to that drug. It is actually the worst thing that like you could ever imagine. And if there's like one or if there's 100 people that misconstrue what I'm saying as something that is like trying to be harmful or glorifying it, I feel like there might be one person who feels less alone and maybe a little bit more courageous to go into that place where they have to face their fear and discomfort in order to get free from that drug. So,
well,
I take the pros with the cons.
I mean, the fact that you've got out of it is hopefully, you know, inspiring to those people too, you know, and congratulations on your sobriety.
Thanks. I mean, it's something you never are fully out of, you know, right, like right. I have obsessive thoughts about using all the time. You know, there are days where it's way, I don't think about it at all. And there are days where like, I'm almost convinced that it's something that I really like, I'm going to do, you know, being bipolar is something that has been challenging with that because my mood will shift in a rapid way, you know, and I'll be down and I'll be very vulnerable in that situation. Yeah. It's difficult to remain like diligent with the tools you have at your disposal to combat those urges when they come up in your mind and things are so intense.
Absolutely. Well, damn, dude. Well, that's thanks for the fan question response.
yeah, no problem, dude.
Well, dude, thank you very much. Anything else you want to add or talk about or plug? I mean, I know you got that tour coming up. That starts pretty soon, right?
Yes, the tour starts, I think, June 28th or 29th in D.C., and the album is out, and man, I'm just so grateful that in a time where, like, guitar music and, you know, is not the most popular thing ever, and I've, you know, having been around on the shelf now for over 10 years, I'm not, like, the freshest tomato out there. It makes me super happy to talk to somebody who cares enough about music to see through all that and like and appreciate it with me. So yeah, my only thing I'd like to add is thanks for paying attention to my music and to my shit.
There you go. Well, Anthony, thank you very much. Appreciate the call and all the best out there, man.
Awesome, Shane. I look forward to it.
Yeah, take care, man.
See you, buddy.
See you. So there it is with Anthony. I absolutely loved speaking with him. Thank you, Anthony, for taking the time. Shout out to his manager, Biggie, one of the best in the business as well. And it was so incredible how honest and forthcoming Anthony was with his answers and talking about his insecurities that he has, and really, really was an awesome listen. I hope you enjoyed it. If you do, again, go on iTunes, write a review, check out the All Access Club, do whatever you can to help the show, tell a friend, tell a loved one, hit the subscribe button. It all goes a long way, and thank you so much for being here. Next week, we will be back with an all-new episode once again, just like every week. And I'm not sure who it is yet. I got a few in the can, but they're all super good, so come back on Tuesday. I always play music at the end of the podcast, and this is particularly difficult due to how prolific Anthony Green is. But I'm going to go with a hit, I'm going to go with a classic, and I'm going to go with a song I never get tired of hearing. So I hope you enjoy it. Here is Circa Survive with Get Out. I'm going to get out. Peace and love. See you next week.
I can't get started from the part where I left off yesterday. Should have spent my time a little wiser. Translate.
want to give a huge thanks and shout out to the following members of the All Access Club. What's up, my centers? Shout out to Julie Popelka, Nathan Riley, Brendan Potter, Josh Lowe, Rainer Ho, Nicholas Schultz. Nice to have you, Nick. Alyssa Lowe, Nicholas Loveland, Robert Scott Lewis, Rahel Schweiler. Sorry if I got that wrong. Seth Powers, Feek, my man from Singapore, Evan Van Howe, Melissa Gilroy, Rebecca Ferrero, Brandon Dave, Mary Beth Bedler, Lisa Buckland, Brennan Drescher, Ford Wesson, Kyle Craig, Tom Mancini, Victoria Varr, Anton Appelros, Philip Fradkin, Travis Reed, Mo Horta, my girl, Caitlin Stevens, my other girl, Cameron Lopez, Christina Springer, Sarah Pauls, Derek James, Tyler Burnworth, straight out of Vegas, Megan Marr, Austin Amos, Connor Lynch, Jesse Basso, Drew McDonald, Ian Scott, if your name was Scott Ian, that would be much cooler, dude, just saying, Kyle Simpkins, Jeffrey Adams, Jordan Krink, Alina England, Eric Layton, Connor Larson, Brandon Ray, great haircut in that photo, man, Trent McDougall, Josh Vandruff, Aiden McLaughlin, Cole Fenn, Johnny Caro, you sly dog, Andre from Cairns, Australia, Will Southard, Markham King, dude, thanks for sending me that Nintendo, very, very cool of you, Christian Harris, Roy Stino, Roldan Kabate, Gabby Marshall, and Toronto's finest, Rigel St. Pierre. Love you all, thanks for the support, thanks for the love, and talk to you all soon on Facebook.